Pretty much everything we touch turns to wastewater. If we drink it, wastewater. If we wash our clothes in it, wastewater. If we water our fields with it, wastewater. Why do humans have such a massive impact on the water cycle? Michelle Baker is a biology professor at Utah State University. She doesn't claim to be a wastewater expert, but she definitely knows the importance of understanding what happens to the water that passes through our bodies and our lives every day.
No one knows what it was that made them go. Explore the dark, dark water.
How do you know so much about wastewater and what's in it?
Well, my area of expertise is in stream and river ecology and primarily focusing on nutrient cycles in streams and rivers. And one of the sources of nutrients to streams and rivers comes from treated effluent that comes from our wastewater systems.
I mean, it's kind of a shame that a stream ecologist has to know so much about wastewater.
I think everybody needs to be concerned about wastewater. I don't think most people know what happens when they flush their toilet, where it goes.
So where does it go?
It goes through this amazing infrastructure that has existed since Roman times in some places to facilities that work to remove the solids from the wastewater so that it doesn't negatively impact downstream water bodies.
I think a lot of people understand that the solids get taken out. Then there's still some liquid left, and that's not the end of the process, right? So what's left in that liquid and what other processes happen before that goes back into the stream?
Well, it depends on the kind of treatment system. So a primary wastewater treatment gets out about 40 to 50% of the solids, and then a secondary treatment system gets out most of the rest. And what's left is all the stuff that's dissolved in the water, which can contain contaminants like metals and pharmaceuticals and personal care products, as well as nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus. Nutrients are not considered toxic by most standards. They're materials that are in the environment that are required for living systems. So the nutrients that we study in my lab are things like nitrogen, which is important in making proteins, and phosphorus, which is involved in making DNA and fats and cell membranes and things like that.
So our local sewage system here in Logan, after it goes through the wastewater treatment plant and through the settling ponds and all the lagoons and everything, at the end of the line, it goes back into the Bear River at Cutler Reservoir. And because of new water quality standards, they are out of compliance for phosphorus and ammonia. Is too much of a good thing a bad thing? Is that what's going on with the nutrients?
Right. Too much of a good thing can be bad. And so when there are excess nutrients, there could be unintended consequences. In Utah, some of those unintended consequences include things like algal blooms. A couple of summers ago, there was a toxic algal bloom in Utah Lake that caused some dogs to die.
From drinking the water or going in it?
Well, the dog probably did drink the water, but the algae that bloom under those high nutrient conditions produce these chemicals called cyanotoxins, which can be neurological or harm the liver, and in some cases cause paralysis or death, like in the case of that dog.
So how are we adding all those extra nutrients into the streams and lakes and into the water cycle?
In a number of ways. First, we do discharge treated effluent into streams and rivers, which carry with them nitrogen and phosphorus. Agricultural runoff from fields and whatnot can add nutrients to water bodies. Atmospheric deposition can contribute some amount of nutrients to water.
That's like dust.
Dust and materials dissolved in the precipitation itself. So there's wet and dry deposition.
So wastewater, I mean, it's easy to think about what goes into our toilets as being wastewater, but we're also talking about water that runs through the streets when it rains. All of the water that sort of goes through our lives, that goes through a city, is considered wastewater. Is that correct?
That's correct. So water that passes, I like to call it a human filter, whether it's our body directly or the systems that we operate.
I heard you say something recently that made me feel a little bit guilty, and that was about pet waste.
Pet waste, yes.
Because I'm really good about picking up after my pet if I know
that it's something somebody might step in. I feel like that's being a good neighbor. But it's not a really good idea to leave pet waste anywhere for water, right?
Right, yeah. So when your pet leaves his deposit behind in the canal, or not in the canal, in the gutter.
Sometimes in the canal. It's happened.
Make sure you clean it up, because that does contribute to nutrient loading. I used to live in France for a year, about 20 years ago, and I would walk to work, and about every meter there was a dog turd. And I just thought, wow, that would be a really great research project.
I want to go back to the nutrient cycle, because I think it's really interesting, and that's what you focus on. Can you just sort of take us through some of the primary nutrients that are found in water and that we need for life, and sort of how that life cycle works?
Sure. So nitrogen occurs in forms that are inorganic, so things that are salts, like potassium nitrate. Could be a fertilizer that you could buy. And that nitrate is a plant available form that can be absorbed by its roots and contribute to the growth of that plant. So that plant will then use that nitrogen to make its tissues, and that converts it into an organic form. And the other end of the nutrient cycle is when that plant material decays, it releases the nitrogen back into an inorganic form that can then be used again. So in terms of how the water cycle impacts that process, can be as a way of transporting inorganic nutrients to other locations, for example, a receiving lake or a reservoir like Cutler, where then the algae and microbes that live in that reservoir then cycle those materials. The Logan River itself has covered with a biofilm on the rocks. And that is part of what makes the Logan River a healthy river. We like to have rivers with biofilms, because those biofilms act like a trickle filter in your aquarium to remove the inorganic nutrients that could cause harm to fish, for example, ammonia, and keep it locked up in the biofilm.
Biofilms are basically like the slippery stuff on rocks that
right,
make it slippery, hard to walk across
exactly,
the stream.
Exactly. So it's the slippery stuff on rocks. And it's a community of bacteria and fungi and algae that work together to purify the water that flows through the river. So a lot of the work that my group has done in the past is trying to understand the role of that biofilm relative to the role of transport of nutrients to downstream receiving waters.
So when you look into a stream and you see some green waving stuff at the bottom of the stream, that's not necessarily bad.
It's not necessarily bad. If it's an overgrowth of algae, it can become a nuisance. But walking across a stream and slipping is a good thing.
And what about when you look at a stream or a pond and there's green bubbly stuff floating on the top of the stream?
I would tend to say that it's probably... I would have to look at the stream, but if it's a lot, I would think, oh, this is a poor, sad stream that needs some help.
A clean stream isn't necessarily pure, clean water with nothing in it, right?
I mean, right.
Streams are supposed to be a little bit dirty and a little bit green and a little bit fuzzy.
Yeah. I was hiking in Colorado several years ago and came across this stream, and was one thing that I always do is I pick up rocks and look for bugs and stuff like that. And the rocks were not slippery at all. And I looked on a map and learned that it was near an acid mine drainage. So it was a sad stream with nothing in it.
What should we be doing to protect our rivers from this human filter that it goes through? I mean, it has to go through, and we rely on rivers and streams for so many aspects of our lives. How can we be responsible for what happens on the other end?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to be aware of the impact that our activities have on rivers and streams and lakes, and to make choices to mitigate those impacts, whether it's cleaning up after your dog or sweeping off your driveway after you put your winter fertilizer on your lawn, to not putting a bunch of food scraps down the garbage disposal, that all those kinds of things can help protect our streams and rivers and lessen the impact of those things on them.
What happens to our food scraps when they go down the garbage disposal?
Well, they go into the wastewater treatment plant, and those guys work really hard to clean up our human waste. But, I mean, that food material that goes down the garbage disposal, it's food for bacteria, and it has nitrogen and phosphorus and who knows what else in it that they've got to treat.
I guess it probably even has more nutrients in it because our bodies
sure
take some of that nutrients out before it goes into the toilet.
Yeah.
So what are you working on right now? What is your current sort of research project?
In terms of the active research projects that we have right now, I'm working with a graduate student named Beth Ogata in the biology department and an undergraduate student named Donald Long, who's at Southern Utah University. And we're trying to understand the effect of certain pharmaceutical products on how biofilms in streams work. And this summer we did an experiment where we grew biofilms that were exposed to diphenhydramine, which is the main ingredient in the over-the-counter drug Benadryl, and caffeine. So an upper and a downer. We gave them a couple of choices there to see what the impact of those chemicals was on the growth of algae and bacteria in streams around Utah. And we don't have our results all pretty so far, but what we found is that there's a substantial decrease in the rate of photosynthesis that the algae are doing. And we're trying to understand if there are changes to the microbial community by looking at using some genomics to see who's there and if it changes.
When we talk about pharmaceuticals in effluent, are we talking about people throwing pills in the trash or down the drain or flushing them down the toilet? Or are we talking about what happens to pharmaceuticals after they go through our bodies?
It's both. So certain pharmaceuticals are not fully metabolized, and so they're excreted, and that contributes to the pharmaceutical load. People do dump their extra pills and stuff down the toilet, and that contributes to the load. So both of those things. And it's bad for the microbes that live in the wastewater treatment plant.
Yeah, I guess, especially like even antibiotics and stuff are probably not good for that.
Yeah, and there's some evidence that it contributes to antibiotic resistance in the environment.
And that probably includes like antibiotic hand wash and things like that. So
yeah, we want that the compound that's in those things is called triclosan. And we wanted to use triclosan as one of our treatments, but we couldn't get it to dissolve in the substance that we are trying to use to expose it to them, so we weren't able to do that. But yeah, it's...
If it's not dissolving in your substance, I wonder how well it's dissolving in the natural system.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
That was biologist Michelle Baker, who studies stream ecology and the delicate balance of nutrients that impact water quality. More wastewater stories are coming up after a short break. The 88,000 or so people served by the City of Logan's sewage treatment plant produce over 12 million gallons of wastewater a day. This is all the water that enters the city sewer system, not just from every toilet in the region, but also washing machines, showers, and kitchen sinks.
So, as all that water collects throughout the different cities, it all ends up coming here to these two large pipes.
Jim Harps is Logan's wastewater treatment manager. He took me on a tour of the whole system, from raw sewage to where the water goes back into the natural system.
And so at this point, you know, the characteristics of the water is, you know, it's pretty brown. As we bring tours in here, kids are always pointing out the chunks of poop going by.
Yeah.
You occasionally see Fruit Loops or paper products going by.
Cigarette butts.
Cigarette butts, corn. I mean, you know, some of that stuff was maybe ingested. Some of it's going down garbage disposals as well. And so, but it's always kind of fun. Always kind of fun to pause and take a look and see what raw wastewater looks like.
I kept waiting for the part of the tour where we went inside a plant, the wastewater treatment plant.
But most of Logan's system consists of man-made ponds called sewage lagoons and man-made wetlands called polishing ponds, which I guess is where the water gets so clean it shines. After that, the water can be used for irrigation, but most of it eventually flows into the Bear River at Cutler Reservoir, where a monitoring station shows that it still has way too much ammonia and phosphorus to be considered clean river water. And with a growing population, the city of Logan won't be able to meet state standards without upping its sewage treatment game. Issa Hamoud is the director of Logan's environmental department. I asked him about the changes in standards and how the city is going to keep up.
2004, the state started doing total maximum daily loading, which is how much phosphorus we discharge every day into the receiving water, which is Cutler Reservoir in this case. And the study was completed right around 2008, and 2010, the state adopted a ruling that we need to reduce about 60 to 64% of the amount of phosphorus we discharge into the Cutler Reservoir.
The sewage lagoons and their microorganisms are really efficient at cleaning up standard pollutants, especially the kinds of things that can make you sick. But naturally occurring nutrients like phosphorus and ammonia coming through the system are harder to get rid of, and they are increasing with the area's population growth. That, combined with new state standards that lower the acceptable amounts of these nutrients, means that Logan needs to get rid of its lagoons in order to keep up.
So lagoons work fine in a smaller community. In fact, in a warmer climate, they even serve better than in this climate. So we've enjoyed the low-cost system for years. They can still serve well if it was not the change in water quality, the significant change in water quality. The new facility capacity would be 18 million gallons a day. But there are days we receive a lot more than 18 million gallons a day, especially in the wet season of the year. For that reason, we're going to keep one or two cells of the lagoons to hold water in a time of a high flow. It is not intended to treat water through the lagoons anymore.
People are weirdly attached to Logan's sewage lagoons. Jim Harps remembers looking down from the Utah State University campus where he was studying public health and being intensely curious about the glimmering quilt squares of water in the middle of the valley floor. Now he manages the lagoons, which don't smell as bad as you'd think, and they're covered with birds, mostly seagulls, but there are some ducks, geese, and swans too.
These are about 9 feet deep right now, the water level. The bottom foot and a half is a layer of sludge that has formed. And so, but yeah, right. we can drive through and take a look.
Let's go chase some seagulls.
Yeah, I always tell all of our tours that the seagulls are trained to move, do not swerve, and so don't want anyone in the drink.
The tour of the lagoons mostly happens inside the heated cab of a city-issued truck. We drive along the causeway that separates the lagoons from each other. At the end of the series of lagoons, the water gets injected with some chlorine that kills any remaining nasty bugs.
Okay, so the water leaves the lagoons, it has about a 2 mile trip out towards Benson to our polishing wetlands. At that point, that water is available to the farmers along that canal, as long as it's during irrigation season. They have a designated irrigation season that's dictated by our permit from the state of Utah, though. So all the water that comes down that canal goes into this little pond over here, inlet pond. Let's drive up here. This is our inlet pond. So any water that's not used for irrigation or everything during the winter comes here to the storage pond. And at this point, we can either push the water into the wetland cells themselves or over to those storage ponds and store that water for later.
The polishing ponds are beautiful. Cattails and bulrushes are the filters of choice here, and if it weren't for the perfectly straight raised dike we're driving on, I don't know that I would be able to tell this was a man-made wetland.
I would love to take a canoe out in here.
Yeah, it's so pretty.
So this time of year we get quite a bit of waterfowl here in the wetlands and then over in our storage ponds also. But we typically have birds and wildlife here year-round, which is always interesting. We actually to a fox that lives down here. I've seen them once or twice, actually. We do have a lot of muskrats. But yeah, you come in the summer, and we get a lot of songbirds, actually, in here as well. So on a summer day, it's actually kind of neat just to be out here and just listen. Yeah, this is our final gate, our discharge gate. At this point, we monitor our flow again. We take all the same samples we do at the headworks and at the last cell of the lagoons as well. That way we're knowing how effectively we are removing everything. And so, yeah, it's a pretty fun process, I think.
So how long ago would I have needed to flush my toilet to see the water come out right here?
That's a great question. I guess depending on where you were when you flushed, how long it took to get to the headworks, plus 90 days in theory, and then you add the time the water conveys from the lagoons to the wetlands and going through the wetlands, and it could be 6-7 months potentially. Like I said, the lagoons work really well on those conventional pollutants most of the year. You're pretty much year round. I mean, we get a few algae blooms that kind of mess things up in the summer, but for the most part, they work quite effectively. It's just those new nutrient criteria that we are struggling at. That's what's killing us at this point.
A steamy lagoon, a tropical moon.
Construction on whatever will end up replacing Logan's sewage lagoons is scheduled to begin in 2017. For The Source, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
A sleepy lagoon and two hearts in tune. In some lullaby, the fireflies gleam, reflects in the stream, they sparkle and shimmer.
Wastewater treatment is a complicated process that's expensive and energy intensive, but it's cheap and easy for the oldest civilizations on Earth. Bacteria. Bacteria are built to break down organic matter. Billions of different types of bacteria live in our sewage treatment plants where they eat human waste and produce methane as a result. And methane is a high-energy gas. It's considered an alternative energy source to fossil fuels. Therefore, the bacteria that live in our wastewater do a double service of processing our waste and creating a sustainable form of energy. To find out why there isn't a methane-burning power plant next to every sewage lagoon in Utah, I visited with Anna Doleman, a Utah State University graduate student from Ukraine.
Okay, I'm studying a PhD in biological engineering, and I'm doing a project on wastewater treatment, converting the wastewater, meaning the poop, into the energy. So creating a whole sustainable cycle of energy source, which we can use to treat our wastewater without the need of external funds and external energy supply.
Anna is crazy passionate about this subject. She loves her bacteria. She calls her lab a kindergarten.
Sometimes they really drive me crazy when they don't want to grow, they want to eat. They're just crying all the time. Am I talking about kids or about bacteria? I sometimes forget.
Anna keeps a very tidy and somehow cozy lab. She has essentially mini versions of the Logan sewage lagoons in test tubes. She has to feed the bacteria and keep it at the right temperature. Basically, she has to keep it alive, and that somehow does make them seem pet-like. But even if she refers to herself as their mother, Anna is first and foremost a scientist.
Currently, I'm testing two different types of bacteria and how they degrade the algae, because the first part of my project is to speed up digestion of the algae. If the algae is harvested from the wastewater lagoons as a waste resource, and then we supply them into the closed little reactor where we don't add oxygen and let the bacteria from the golden sediments of the wastewater lagoons to do the work of converting this algae into the biogas, which is the fuel which we are aiming for. And so far I have identified several types of bacteria which are able to digest the algae properly and promote the transformation process into the fuel. And I'm testing right now their activity.
Why do they have to get shaken up like that?
They're sort of doing the perfect hula.
Yeah, they just really love dancing. Actually, it keeps the solution of algae, nutrient media, and bacteria homogenized. So everything is suspended in the homogeneous system, and it means that every bacteria is able to constantly access whatever amount of algae it wants to access.
So if it wasn't moving, maybe the algae would float to the top.
And algae will separate at the bottom and they will never meet each other. It will be such a pity.
How do they find each other in nature?
In nature, that's what happens in the wastewater lagoons, because we have sediments which are already in the wastewater lagoons for more than 50 years. And as algae do their job of converting the sunlight energy and the phosphorus into their biomass, they become very fat and they die, and they settle down to the bottom of the pond where bacteria open up their mouths and they just consume the algae which are falling down. And it's like creation of the fossil fuels, actually, where many million years ago we had the soil samples which were covered with the dust, with some bacteria, and exposed to the air, to the sunlight. And as the animals were dying off, they were creating these fossil fuels, which we then find in terms of the oil and all the useful things. And the same process is happening at the bottom of the Logan Lagoons, where bacteria meet the algae, meet the food source, and convert it to something useful. That's why we can see in the wastewater lagoons the bubbles coming out sometimes.
How many different kinds of bacteria are there in any given sewage lagoon?
Billions?
I
cannot even count or describe them. Like, according to my studies of isolating the DNA from the sample of the sediments taken at the sediments of the Logan Lagoons, I identified more than thousands of different species of bacteria, and they are all doing different types of jobs. And what is really beautiful and neat is that they all form a huge complex ecosystem which is doing its job and we are just watching them doing their job.
Are you isolating
tons
of bacteria to find out what part of the chain they're in?
Yep, that's true.
So how many different bacteria have you identified?
So far I have identified 15-16 species, different types of bacteria, and I have tested all of them in a really draft way, just for the visual qualitative approach to see if there is a color change when they are eating algae or not. And right now I'm testing quantitatively how much algae, how quickly, and what is the period of time they can eat the algae.
She's looking for the best combination of bacteria that will eat the algae that exists naturally in the sewage ponds and break it down efficiently into methane, which you'll remember is the desired end product of all of this. Methane is currently being produced by Logan's sewage lagoons, but it's not really enough to capture. In order for Anna's bacteria to create enough methane to be worth commercializing, there needs to be more bacteria, which is more efficient at digesting algae, and it needs to be more concentrated, not spread out over acres and acres.
Another thing is if we will have a reactor where all these bacteria will be combined, and we will on purpose provide them the feedstock, algae, and they will chew it, and because they are in a closed space, the gas which they will produce will be concentrated. We can get it and use it as an energy source.
They're already doing this in Europe.
US is a little bit behind on this technology. Hopefully it will catch up soon. But European countries such as Netherlands and Germany, they have been using this technology for a long time already, and they are treating most of their wastewater in such a way that they put it into the closed tank without oxygen, and they have a special mixture of bacteria which are able to chew this waste and produce the gas. And then they use the gas for the internal needs, or even if the wastewater treatment facility is close to the city and it's generating a lot of the gas, it can supply the electricity, the gas in the form of electricity to the city. So people in the city are not only paying really low sewage bills, but they even get an additional energy source, which is really cool.
So if this technology already exists, why did Anna come all the way to Utah to study biogas-producing bacteria in Logan's sewage lagoons?
There hasn't been done a lot of identification of bacteria. In Europe, they are using a mixture. They don't know. In 99%, they don't know what's inside this mixture. It's just because this mixture has worked before, produced a lot of gas, degraded all the waste that they have, and they are just using it. Nobody cares about microbiology behind. But if we know the microbiology, which I'm trying to prove here, we have the power. We have the power to know exactly what kind of components to put into the cake mixture, how to bake this cake, and how to enjoy it. And that's the novelty behind. And if we create this consortia, the mixture of bacteria, it can be distributed and used by whoever wants to use it.
I'm very uncomfortable with your cake metaphor.
Some bacteria do smell really good. I'm just kidding.
Until we have Anna's secret cake recipe, we're going to continue to pay relatively high sewage treatment bills in places like Logan. I live in a two-person household in a small house, and over one-third of my city utility bill goes to sewage treatment. Between sewer and stormwater services, it's about $35 a month. Anna thinks this is way too much.
I'm horrified every day, knowing that we can change it, we can decrease the price by just creating an internal cycle of using our own energy from the biofuel. It just really drives me crazy. Ugh.
Anna Dolman. She tries to train bacteria to do our dirty work even better in her little kindergarten on the campus of Utah State University.
They are so awesome, but I don't want to touch them without gloves. I don't want to bring them home. All the magic which is done in the lab should stay in the lab.
They'll eat all your algae at home.
Yes! And my cheese.
Sun goes down and the moon comes up. I turn into a teenage goo goo muck.
This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Big cities have gotten good at testing and treating wastewater, but the sewers below Utah's urban areas still carry small amounts of chemicals that shouldn't be there. So what's being done to address that? The Source's Ross Chambliss asked Salt Lake City's wastewater manager.
You'd better duck when I show up, the goo-goo muck.
Tom Ward is a deputy director for Salt Lake City's Department for Public Utilities. That's the department that delivers clean water to our taps and removes the dirty water from our sinks and toilets. Ward says Salt Lake City has actually come a long way since the 1850s when it comes to wastewater.
Salt Lake City in the 1850s, one of the first things they did is passed an ordinance for removing the filth from the streams. And shortly after that, there was construction of sewer lines to get rid of, the foul, waste from human habitation. That recognition early on of the impact of wastewater to the public health and the environment has been an underpinning not only of Salt Lake City, but the development of the Western world and where we're at today, being about 100 years ahead of maybe Africa or other areas in undeveloped areas where they don't have sanitation has been important. In the 1800s, we had, 10 to 20 people dying each year and a few hundred people getting sick from public health and sanitation. So getting the city sewered in the late 1800s was important. They constructed a sewer pipe that took the wastewater outside the city. There was a study in, I believe, the 1850s of how far can a fly fly, because it was posited at that time that Well, if we know that the flies can't fly back, they won't bring back any of the viruses or vectors, you know, that might impact us. So that location, the Salt Lake City Sewage Farms, is out just north of the existing Salt Lake City wastewater plant towards the Great Salt Lake.
Today, since the Clean Water Act in the 1970s, American cities must use the best technologies available to keep our water clean. Ward says the process is simple and elegant, just like how our own bodies process nutrients and dispose of them. Similar to most water treatment plants, Salt Lake City's plant runs its sewer system through a process of filters. Physical filters, like screens, remove most of the solid waste. A biological filter uses microbes to eat up all the organic matter in the water. And finally, there's a chemical screening process, such as chlorine or UV light, to disinfect the water before it gets channeled into the Great Salt Lake. Ward says Salt Lake City's facility processes about 33 million gallons every day. It's the second largest facility in the state. Wastewater also generates solid matter, called biosolids.
The state has a couple of standards for that. There's what they call a Class A biosolids. That's something that you could take to retail and buy it at a store. And in fact, some communities do that. Some of the fertilizers you might use from a local store might have been produced from a treatment plant, you know, nitrogen and phosphorus. We don't do that locally here now, but that's where we're headed. We produce what we call a Class B solids, which is not available for retail use, like on public access, but that's sent out to Kennecott, who uses that to reclaim their tailings. So it's a resource that's recovered instead of having a barren landscape for their mining restoration. They use our biosolids then for to amend the soils, and those microbes then go to work in a renewable environment.
Interesting. I do want to ask you about that specifically, because I understand that for in some circles, the use of biosolids is specifically for agricultural use, even perhaps for growing food in some cases. It can be a contentious issue just for people who are perhaps aware of that these biosolids can be used for this. I guess the concern a lot of people may have is just that these can come, depending on what has been in the sewage system, various types of chemicals and flame retardants and heavy metals and pharmaceuticals and that kind of thing. And the concern is, does that get into our crops? Does this get into our food supply?
Very good question. And that back to this regulatory, so the EPA and the state of Utah have regulations. This Class A biosolids both requires a process that maybe one of the most important ones that I'll mention for your listeners is high temperatures that would kill the viruses. And so those that are producing a Class A solids, in fact, Salt Lake City's, ours most often tests out as a Class A, but since we're not selling it to the general public, we don't make sure every single load is doing that because Kennecott has a restricted site where they use ours. But those that send it to agriculture, and there are facilities here that send theirs to agriculture, and that's been part of what we've been doing for millennia, really. Just now, when we take it to a high temperature, that kills those viruses and takes it out of a dangerous realm. So it's a highly regulated and highly tested practice. By the same token, those biosolids are rich in what a farmer would want is phosphorus, nitrogen, potassium, other minerals. And as opposed to them going and acquiring those from an extractive industry, you know, where they're mined, and so now you have all these greenhouse gases and the fuels to mine it and truck it and haul it and expense, those farmers now are using, they use a local resource to just renew the soil. And I like to use the word elegant, you know, in the way that a lot of people don't think about it. You know, obviously the concerns are there, but once we address those concerns, it's a really robust, sustainable use of what everyone produces every day, 365 days a year.
Sure.
You know, send it back to the environment in a good way.
But a 2009 study by a group called the Environmental Working Group found a total of 316 different chemicals in our water supply nationally, even though the EPA only regulates 114 of them. Various pharmaceuticals, caffeine, flame retardants, and estrogen are among the emerging contaminants regularly found in American wastewater systems. Some of these chemical compounds may be purposefully flushed down the toilet. Some may just be pharmaceuticals passing through people's bodies. It's a concern because treatment centers may not be testing or specifically treating the water for these trace chemicals. So how do we know what chemical compounds may be in our own wastewater system?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So part of it is the evolution of technology. Today we can sample and test for all kinds of compounds and minerals. They have, you know, instruments that measure in the what they call the nanoparticle level, as opposed to, you know, 30 years ago it was parts per million. We're really excited about, you know, one part in a million that we'd be able to discover that. Now they have parts per billion, parts per trillion. So the deeper we go, we can analyze things. Now, because we can see something that is there that we didn't see before, doesn't mean it's necessarily bad. As I mentioned, my body needs selenium and molybdenum for essential life functions. You get too much of either of those, that's a bad thing. So detection levels have allowed us to see something's there that it's a surprise. No, it's a part of the environment. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control, and the Environmental Protection Agency have a whole regime of exploring what they call emerging contaminants. So now that we can see it, is it a problem? Is it an issue? And when they look at both an environmental impact or an impact to the public health, they then test, okay, if someone has this in their environment, either through their skin or through the air, or in our case, eating or drinking, you know, when does that become a risk? So they run through a regime of, you know, studies of looking at people and their habits and their environment and what they eat and drink. The test that the CDC uses is on the order of someone drinking that water with that contaminant. I think it's about a liter of water a day for something like 40 or 50 years for a 100-pound individual. So that's a pretty robust threshold to say, hey, that's a risk. And for your listeners, I think one thing to think about, you know, walking out in the sunlight, that's a risk, you know, and people, to totally protect yourself from the sun, that would not be practical and wouldn't be very fun, right? Mm. So I wouldn't be alarmed in the sense that there's a risk in everything we do and everything we consume, and that the EPA and CDC are always looking at those emerging contaminants to see, now that we can see it's there, is it an impact to the environment?
Utah's Department of Health urges people not to flush down their old prescription medications and pills, but instead turn them in at depositories for safe disposal. Still, the water that we drink along the Wasatch Front, or across most of Utah for that matter, is only drunk once. Unlike other parts of the country, there's no need for concern that we're somehow ingesting someone else's antidepressants or residual caffeine via our tap water. But such a reality may not be far off for Utah, since the state's population continues to grow, even as our water resources are more limited. Do you think there ever may be a time where we might get to a point where we seriously think maybe it would be better for us to begin retreating or recycling this water that we consume ourselves to make it drinkable?
Today, most of us in some fashion are drinking recycled wastewater. It might have been, it's been recycled for millennia, for millions of years. And even today, so you, I give you the example of, here in Salt Lake, we look up at our mountains, we see the snow, it melts, it comes to our tap. But that doesn't mean, you know, there are reservoirs and systems where we drink water that's come through reservoirs and watersheds that have the potential for, you know, that type of, for, that's gone through a community and come through a wastewater plant. Now, I don't want to be alarmist, because all the drinking water plants do aggressive testing and sampling to make sure that the drinking water that comes to you is healthy. So I want to make that clear. And there are technologies being applied. For instance, I mentioned disinfection, and we're finding that for the pharmaceuticals topic we were just talking about, that the disinfection technologies we use also, we're finding, removes the pharmaceuticals to a certain degree and some of those, what we call those emerging contaminants. So I would, you know, be very comfortable and rest assured on that. I wouldn't go out. I don't drink bottled water. In fact, the bottled water industry is far less regulated than the water from your tap. So in Salt Lake City, it always rubs me a little wrong when people say, oh, I drink bottled water. You're probably safer drinking water from the tap. That being said, to your point of reuse of water, you know, what they call direct potable reuse, I think that's what most people think about. Okay, it's coming straight from that wastewater plant coming to my tap. They're doing that in Texas and Arizona and other places. Here in Utah, right now our water resource portfolio calls for a certain level of reuse, but the fact that we need a significant part of our water demand is outside, and when you put water outside on a grass, it also happens to need some of these nutrients and other things. So the strategy that most entities are taking is, rather than putting a lot of energy into treating all the water for drinking water consumption, let's separate that out and take that to reuse on our parks, on our golf courses, on our landscapes, and let's treat at the higher level for that which we drink, but then we will reuse, you know, this other fraction. Salt Lake City has a study underway, and we've planned for many years to have reuse as part of our portfolio, if you will. We had looked into that 15 years ago. At that point in time, the cost of technology to treat wastewater to meet the state standards for safe reuse, you know, even though you're not drinking it, you don't want wastewater on your park, you know, mm-hmm. with your dog and your kids and everything else, mm-hmm. unless it meets the state and federal regulations for that. So that cost of that treatment was actually more expensive than our current water resources we have, at least in Salt Lake City. Part of that's because we have water that flows by gravity to us, and it's very, you know, the investment we made in watershed protection, you know, to keep things from getting, you know, dirty to begin with, has made Salt Lake City's water supply and many of the other communities along the Wasatch Front, we have pretty inexpensive water. Part of the reason is because it's clean from the start. Our strategy over the next 10 years to 20 years, I anticipate that we'll have reuse being used on our parks and open space, which is a smart way to do that.
Tom Ward is a deputy director for Salt Lake City's Department for Public Utilities. For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
The Source comes from the studios of Utah Public Radio with major support from iUtah. I always thank reporter Ross Chambliss and producer Ryan Cunningham, but today I really, really, really mean it. I'm thankful for you both and your help in making The Source an audio reality every month. Special thanks to all our wastewater hero guests, Michelle Baker, Tom Ward, Anna Doleman, Issa Hamoud, and Jim Harps. I'm Jennifer Pemberton, grateful that you've taken an hour out of your brown Friday to listen to The Source. Tell me why you're thankful for wastewater treatment. I'm always talking about water over on Twitter. Find me at Year of Jen. The hashtag for the show is UPR Source. We're back next month with more water stories. Thank you for listening.